stuff like
yeah.
that. But there's a lot of other things going on in medical science. You know, the transhumanists are talking about some of the things that medical science is beginning to play around with.
Yeah.
There, you know, geneticists for years have been maintaining that the way it looks to them, the human genome looks like it was engineered to last at least, you know, for a lifespan at least 120 years. And yet, for some reason, we seem to shut down normally between 70 and 80. Although it's been getting longer, you know.
Well, with all the crappy food that we've got and Fukushima fish and everything, I mean, chemtrails, you name it.
Yeah, but nonetheless, you know, medical science, it's going to get to the point, and I kind of even hinted about that in the very end of the very first book of that I wrote in this whole alternative field, you know, the Giza Death Star, that it's going to get to the point where people will start living much longer lifespans than currently. And it's not so far-fetched, you know, when you look back at ancient technology, the way I have attempted to do in some of those books, Cosmic War and so on, you have extraordinarily long lifespans of people. That's even recorded in the Bible, although it's not lifespans like you find in the Egyptian or Sumerian kings lists where, you know, people are living tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years long. It's going to get to that point, so that's one thing, you know, and you have to look at some of these power elites, and they seem to live suspiciously long.
Yes, they do.
You know, I'm thinking in particular of David Rockefeller. He's in his 90s.
Yep.
But if you look at the man, he doesn't really look like someone in his 90s. He looks like someone more maybe in his early 70s. Queen Elizabeth II is also getting way up there, but, you know, she doesn't look her age. Certainly.
Right.
And, you know, even my mother lived until she was 86, but she didn't look until the very end. She didn't look like she was in her 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So people are living longer. That's one advance in technology. That's just sort of happening. And I think when you add to that genetic therapies, when you add the advent of medical nanotechnology, the ability to go in and repair cells on a cellular level. When you add some of the alternative medical therapies that you can read about on the internet that, you know, seem to be indicating that they suppress a great deal of medical advancements in cancer and other diseases. I think about 10 years ago, I heard of a case of a man that had come down with full-blown AIDS and had gone off to Germany to some sort of clinic there. And they did some sort of procedure and completely cleaned him from the disease. So, you know, there's all these stories out there, and you hear so many of them. That, you know, I'm of the philosophy, George Ann, where there's smoke, there's fire.
Oh, yeah.
So there's medical advances. The other thing that is a burgeoning technology that we talked about in the transhumanism book is simply the information technology
that
has exploded. We now have the ability to carry entire libraries on effectively what looks like a laptop computer. Now, I'm personally not opposed to that, but yet at the same time, I'm not jumping on the bandwagon, and I'll tell you why. I think it's still essential for people to have hard copy books.
Oh, yes.
Because it's much more difficult to change an author's words.
Yes.
And I think, you know, I think the push on the part of certain governments to electronic media, electronic signatures, and so on, is really a disguised push for the ability to manipulate information that they don't like.
Oh my goodness! Well, yeah, that's
well, yeah. You know, it's the old Soviet encyclopedia. You know, you go back and you look at those things, early encyclopedias of Stalin with pictures with Yezhov, and well, you know, he had Yezhov executed, so we just brush him out of the picture. Depending on the year of the Soviet encyclopedia. Well, you know, you don't have to go to all that length anymore. You just push a button and, you know, change a text, change a picture. So I'm skeptical of that development, but it's already here. You know, you can carry libraries with you now in something that is the size of a laptop, and many people buy their books that way now.
Oh, dear. Well, they'll be going crazy if something happens to the grid.
Well, yeah, this is the other thing.
Yeah.
There's every evidence that there are energy technologies, as you and I both know, that have been suppressed for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, technology, that kind of technology really, and again, I think that Richard Dolan has it absolutely correctly, that you've interviewed a couple times on your show, that the people that have access to this technology really constitute a kind of a breakaway civilization, a different entity altogether from what you and I live in.
Yeah.
So, and again, you know, the obvious thing, I think that there's definitely a secret aerospace technology.
Oh, yeah.
I was standing outside a couple of nights ago smoking my pipe. And, you know, I like to stand outside at night and look at the stars and so on. And I was looking up, and I saw this flashing light, like landing lights, you know, airplane lights.
Mm-hmm.
But it was moving across the sky so fast.
Yeah.
It couldn't possibly have been either a commercial plane or even a military jet flying, you know, with the afterburners on.
Yeah.
And it was flying much faster than that. And I was listening, you know, I stood outside listening for a sound of the jet, and there was no noise.
Yeah.
You know, this was clearly some sort of aircraft, but there was no noise, and it was moving at a tremendous speed. So it was something unusual. I don't know what it was, but, so, yeah, there's all of this stuff out there, Georgianne, and I'll tell you what I think is going on. And it just kind of... It kind of hit me yesterday when someone asked me to do an interview, me and Dr. DeHart to do an interview on the transhumanism book. It hit me that the transhumanist movement may perhaps be a way for the people who have possession of this technology to accustom us to the changes in culture that it's going to bring. In other words, what they're doing is the transhumanism movement may be a kind of controlled release of information. They're, in other words, they're preparing us to roll out something.
Oh, boy.
You know, the other thing that I think is a clear sign that they're rolling stuff out is this 3D printing phenomenon.
Yeah, we are.
You know, 3D printing, to be honest, has been around for about 2 to 3 decades. You know, that's when it first started to be talked about publicly, but they're really pushing it now.
Mm-hmm.
And even when it was rolled out, you know, and became public, I think it is a technology that definitely originated in the Black Projects world.
Oh, it had to.
It had to, because, yes, exactly. Well, now, I've got a blog coming up on my website. Now they're talking about building houses with this stuff. Now, can you imagine erecting a fairly large house in a day?
Yeah.
You know, framing the whole thing out in a day.
Okay.
With no humans doing it. You know, you just program a plan into a computer and it spits out the concrete and voila, there you are.
Well, Joseph, the other day I called an ammo company to check on some ammo and we got to talking and he said, yeah, we've got an order in for 3D printed bullets.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah, I believe it.
I just almost fell off my chair.
Well, yeah, this is going to transform... this is going to transform society tremendously. And they have to be careful about releasing technologies like this too fast, because the economic dislocation that it could cause would be tremendous. You know, if they all of a sudden decided to start building houses with 3D printing, well, you know, it's going, ultimately that's going to bring the cost of housing down dramatically. Well, but you see, the problem is there. It's also going to throw a huge monkey wrench into the housing construction industry, or for that matter, any kind of construction. So they have to do this slowly, but I think it's very telling that they're pushing the whole thing dramatically in the past couple of years, and in the major media. So, you know, whenever the major media starts pushing themes or memes, I pay attention, because that means the power elites that own the media are getting ready to do something transformative.
Oh, boy.
So, you know, there's a lot going on.
With the 3D printing, I don't see why they can't print gold coins and silver coins.
Well, sure. You know, they're already developing, there is talk already of developing 3D printers that actually use metal as the extrusion. So, it will change minting, it will change construction, gun ownership, parts manufacture, you know, you name it. It's going to bring about a tremendous change of things. And even to a certain extent, it's going to change shipping a great deal.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, why bother to send someone a package when you can just download a part and print it up on your computer? So, you know, look out, UPS, a lot of your business is going to go by the wayside. And eventually, you know, for people like me that are addicted to hard copy books, you know, it's conceivable that you're going to have a version of a 3D printer that will just print up and bind your book right there in your home, you know, download.
Wow.
So, you know, there's all sorts of changes. We're on the cusp of something major, and all of this too. You know, there's inevitably going to be military applications of all of this, genetics, nanotechnology applications of this. Personally, there's a very interesting thing that I mentioned earlier when I said information processing. They've been after, for quite some time, quantum computers.
Yeah.
Now, for the information processing illiterate like me,
and me,
quantum computers, you know, your computer relies on the flow of electrons inside of your computer circuits, and essentially the computer circuits themselves have only two things that they can do. They can be on or off.
Yeah.
So computers are just, you know, processing information through gobs of these on and off switches, all right? So you have to imagine each little node that's processing all of this information inside of your computer as having only two possible states. And what quantum computing is talking about is the electron exists, you know, in the standard model, it exists in seven possible states. So imagine taking all of those gates and switches in your computer chip, and instead of each one of them having two possible states, imagine each one of them having seven.
Oh, my gosh.
So the computer you have on your desk right now with, you know, X terabytes is going to be leaping forward almost an order of magnitude, and probably will leap forward an order of magnitude into petabytes and so on and so forth.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, just stop and think. Richard Hoagland is fond of saying in some of his presentations, and he's exactly right, that we now, each one of us probably listening to this show, has more computing power on our desk
than
all of NASA had
in
the 1960s.
Yes.
And that computing power occupied whole rooms.
Yeah. I used to have a computer on wheels a long time ago.
Yeah, you know. I used to have one of those abacuses, too. And you go further back towards just after the Second World War, or even back into the Second World War, and look at the computers that they were using then. Vacuum tubes and great big huge clunky cables that had to be physically plugged in as part of the programming of the computer to perform a certain function. So you had people that were trained to do nothing, like telephone operators, and take these cables and unplug them from this hole and plug them into that hole, and that whole system of manipulating the cables was the way you programmed the computer.
Oh, boy.
You know, until the integrated circuit came along and you were able to program without having to rewire the machine.
Yeah.
It's huge, is what we're facing. And all of this, like I say, all of this is going to have military applications, inevitably. So, the world's going to go through a huge change, and it's already underway. And I think part of what we see going on is it's going to create the biggest effect, Georgianne, that all of this is going to have, is it's going to have an effect on population, just like the Industrial Revolution did. If you look at what the effect of the Industrial Revolution, it actually brought populations down because you did not need laborers to perform, certain tasks. Well, just imagine that phenomenon happening on an enormous scale.
Oh, boy.
You know, and it's going to be global. It's not going to be, you know, all these people that are talking and worried about the elites wanting to kill off billions of people. I don't think they really have to worry too much about that, because it's going to happen naturally.
How so?
Well, again, I'm using the Industrial Revolution as the example. When that happened, you had less need for laborers to perform tasks that were now being done by the machines. So, as an inevitable consequence, birth rate drops. Where's the birth rate the highest? It's in the non-industrialized countries.
Right.
And, you move out of Africa or parts of Asia into Europe or the Western Hemisphere and the industrialized nations, and the birth rate's much lower. So I think, that's simply going to happen as an inevitable outcome of some of these technological developments.
Wow. Well, they certainly are developing a lot of technology. And, it's like remember the Phoenix Lights?
Yes, I sure do.
Well, that is a craft that that we built and own.
Well, I don't know. I can't say that for sure. There is a segment within the UFO community that argues that some of these triangular craft that people have been seeing, I'm thinking not just the Phoenix Lights, but you have the famous Belgian triangular UFOs, remember those that were such the rage back in the, I think, in the 1990s?
Mm-hmm.
And in Illinois, and more sightings of these things in Illinois. Some of these things are just incredibly large.
Yes.
And there's an argument within some circles of the UFO community that they're too large to have been built by humans. Now, I'm not convinced of that. I think it's entirely possible that you might be looking at a kind of a rigid dirigible, a Zeppelin, that's been framed out, that's full of inert, lighter-than-air gas, and that propels itself around silently by electrogravitic type of propulsions that you mentioned earlier. And I even have a blog coming up about that on the website. I have a picture of the big Boeing assembly plant in Everett, Washington, and it's just this monstrously huge building.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's possible that we can build things fairly large, and maybe flying some of them around.
Well, the other day, somebody sent me a link to a Bob Dean video.
Right.
And he talked about these electrogravitic
gravitic systems. Yeah.
Yeah, and that we've had those for quite a while.
Yeah.
And we fly things around. But what I always wonder, Joseph, where do they keep these things? Are they off-world? Are they in the middle, you know, in Alice Springs in Australia? Where?
Well, that's another good question. My guess is if they base them on Earth, they have to be based remotely.
Yeah.
And probably in disguised facilities.
Yeah.
Facilities that look natural on the outside but aren't.
Yeah.
But my guess is if they have things that big flying around, that the best place to park them would be in orbit.
Yeah.
Even further out. That would be my guess. But, you know, I haven't seen the video that you're talking about with Mr. Dean. I've met Mr. Dean.
Yeah.
But, I haven't seen that particular video. My whole thinking there goes back to an interesting thing that President Reagan put in his memoirs, and I'm kind of surprised it made past the censors. And I forget exactly where in his memoirs, Georgianne, that he states this, but he states something to the effect that when he was debriefed by the Carter administration transition team,
yeah,
that he was told that the United States had a space capacity to move at one time, to move 300 personnel.
Mm-hmm.
Now stop and think what that admission really is, because the space shuttle, if I recall, the public technology that everyone was familiar with, one space shuttle could orbit at best 7 astronauts and a payload.
Yeah.
Or perhaps, you know, if you filled that whole payload bay of the space shuttle up, you could fill it maybe with, you know, 30 or 40 people. So the ability to move around in space at one time, 300 people, is the equivalent of saying we had the ability to move around in space a Navy destroyer.
Yeah.
You know? So, That was quite an admission to make in the early 1980s. And,
yeah.
You know, just do the math here, folks. It's now 30 years plus since President Reagan was sworn into office. So what that capacity may be now, it's anybody's guess. My guess is that Mr. Dean is correct, that we have some sort of rudimentary field propulsion technology and have been using it in space. To what purpose, I don't know.
He said it's absolutely silent.
Oh, yeah, it would be. Yeah, of course it would be. You might hear occasionally, if you were close enough to something like that, and given the kind of electrical potentials involved,
mm-hmm.
If you were close enough to it and it was close enough to the ground, you might occasionally hear crackling noises or you know, kind of the buzz that you associate with high voltage or static electricity.
Yeah.
But, you know, if it's at altitude above you, you're not going to hear anything. It's just going to move. It would absolutely, absolutely quietly.
Oh.
The other thing it's possibly capable of doing is you're manipulating electrical fields of extreme strength and magnetic fields. So it's also conceivable that it would have certain kinds of stealth properties against radar up to, and possibly, depending on how advanced you want to make all this, and possibly including optical stealth.
Oh, boy.
In other words, invisibility.
Yeah.
So, you know, and they're now talking openly in the literature about, you know, in optical invisibility, and they're
yeah.
showing you strange things that they've invented to do it and accomplish it. So that's not, you know, that's now public. So in other words, they probably got that capability as well, and they have probably had it for some time.
And
so,
moved on from there.
And moved on, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, moved on from there. So, yeah, we... you know, the mundane world of gasoline and jet planes that you and I live in is not the world that some of these people live in.
Yeah.
It's a very different one.
Yeah, well... Joseph, you know my feeling about Mars. I think we have a colony there. And I think we have a colony on the moon and have had a colony on the moon for some time.
Well, it's entirely possible if you grant the proposition that these technologies exist.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't take that much to construct a pressure vessel to move from the Earth to the Moon. I mean, my word, we've done that before.
Yeah.
So that doesn't take anything, and it's much easier if you have this big ship that conceivably can propel itself by that means. It's much easier to move that between the Earth and the Moon and keep it invisible, you know, from prying eyes. And do all sorts of stuff, and by the same token, you know, the moon's right next door, and Mars is just kind of like a weekend trip or something like that. So, you know, sure, it's feasible, it's possible. It may explain, just since we're brainstorming here a bit,
yeah.
and subjecting ourselves to high-octane speculation.
Yeah.
It's conceivable that a secret or unknown human colony on Mars
mm-hmm.
might explain these strange incidents that have happened to Martian space probes
oh,
that
yeah.
are public. You know,
the
Russian Phobos 2 probe that had that very strange photo that it took just before it went blank. The strange little episode of the Martian surface rover that had its nice little solar panels all nicely dusted off.
Right. I can just hear NASA saying, hey, Joe, you need to come out here and clean off the solar panels.
Clean off the solar panels.
Yeah.
The rover isn't working. You know, once you start down this path, that's the problem. You know, at what point did they have access to this technology and were able to use it in that fashion? That's the real problem here. I suspect that by now
mm-hmm.
they've had it for some time.
Yeah.
Why they keep it secret and why they're moving so quickly to bring some of this out in the open, that's the real question.
Well, I think they've kept a lot of this secret because of religious concerns.
Well, that's the reason that
that's the reason that the
Brookings Report gave when it did that study back in the late 50s and 60s
for
NASA. I've never bought that line of reasoning for the simple reason that other than American fundamentalists,
right.
The rest of the Christian world isn't that theologically illiterate.
Yes. Your words, not mine.
Not mine. Okay, so send all those angry emails to Dr. Farrell, folks. Not to Georgia.
Although I agree with you.
So send some of those emails to Georgia. No, I've never bought that because, you know, there are long-standing doctrines and traditions within Judaism and Islam and Christianity of higher powers, intelligences, angels, jinns, you know, whatever you wish to call them, that if you examine the doctrine carefully, they're telling you that these are other life forms, other intelligent life forms, that are very sophisticated and super advanced. And what do they do? Well, you know, the Muslim tradition of the jinn is basically a genie. You know, they perform magic.
Yeah.
But like Arthur C. Clarke used to say, any sufficiently advanced form of science is going to appear to be magic to people that don't have it.
Exactly.
So, you know, I never, even in my church association days, Georgiana, I never got terribly upset about the idea of extraterrestrials or anything like that. It wasn't gonna make me stop believing in God or what have you.
Right.
I think that really was a bit of a cover story for what they were really afraid of. And I think what they were really afraid of is something I wrote about and that you and I have talked about in conjunction with covert wars and clash of civilizations, and that's the idea of the Tower of Babel moment of history.
Yes.
Because by the end of World War II, you had obviously something very bizarre and strange going on inside of Nazi Germany in terms of their black project.
Yeah.
That, as far as my research goes, I think was continued after the war, both in American black projects and Russian black projects and British black projects, but also by the Nazis themselves independently.
Yeah.
But you also had the UFO phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And that phenomenon, the parts of that phenomenon that they could not attribute to independent developments of Nazi research or their own black projects, that gave them pause because they knew, judging from the behavior of some of these things, that it was a potential threat. And that they appeared to be greatly concerned with nuclear weapons for whatever reason. And the thinking I've come to conclude that they probably came to the conclusion was that we're in a period of history now where we are either going eventually to have them intervene in human affairs and put us in the Tower of Babel situation once again, where they block our technological progress and perhaps even set us back several notches on the civilization peg.
Well,
or,
let me interject something. You know, we've got congressmen and senators, oh, go bomb Iran, go bomb Syria, go bomb. I hope that these ET people totally destroy every nuclear weapon on this planet.
Well, if they were going to do that, they would have done it by now.
Oh, boy.
That's the problem. They've shown an inordinate curiosity, but it's been to me, Georgiana, like watching a game of interstellar gunboat diplomacy.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, and I think Colonel Corso put it best, they haven't done so and didn't do so when they had the window of opportunity.
Well, but they can make a window of opportunity at any time.
That assumes that they're much more advanced than we are, and that's the problem. I think that the indicators are that in that period from the end of World War II up to, say, around the middle of the Reagan administrations.
Yeah.
I think during that window you had the real danger period of the Tower of Babel moment. That if there was an intervention of that sort, it would have been in that time period.
Mm.
There wasn't, because somehow there was a kind of a crash development, a huge Manhattan Project to develop these types of technologies we've been talking about. And, you know, my thinking is that there has been a careful game of shots fired across the bow.
Yeah.
On both parts. And that's why. And the other thing we have to remember here is that some of these UFO sightings, and I detailed a lot of them in Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations,
yeah,
that were collected by early UFO organizations like NICAP.
Yeah.
All right. And incidentally, NICAP's founder was who? Thomas Townsend Brown, mm-hmm. the American physicist. And what did he specialize in? Well, electrogravitics.
Yeah.
Okay. So NICAP collected a lot of these UFO reports. And if you look through, they published a book in 1967. It's an excellent compendium if you can find a place to sell you a copy. It's an excellent compendium of UFO reports that NICAP had assembled up to that point. And if you read through this very thorough assembly of those reports, I'd say roughly about 30, perhaps to 40% of those reports indicate hostile behavior on the part of UFOs towards human civilian airliners, trains, cargo aircraft, ships, in one or two instances, even cars. Behavior that forced evasive action on the part of the human pilots responding to these things. So you've got that. You've got instances of actual apparent some sort of weaponry being used against human military targets. And then, of course, you've got all of that stuff where UFOs have been turning on and turning off our missiles,
mm-hmm.
you know, starting the count and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So that's going to be interpreted by the power elites, be they in the Soviet Union or Great Britain or wherever, as hostile action, as threatening action.
Yeah.
And they're going to respond by developing technologies to respond to it. I think that window of opportunity for some of the UFO pilots closed sometime during the Reagan administration. I think ultimately that you have with Ronald Reagan and his Star Wars program, you have the public statement, the first public statement of the policy that I think governed the American national security, military, industrial complex, breakaway civilization, whatever you wish to call it, from the end of World War II up to then. And that policy was, first of all, develop a technology that can defend the West against a Soviet thermonuclear attack.
Yeah.
And in doing the development of that technology, you're trying to develop a technology that the Soviet Union cannot keep pace with economically.
Oh.
Technologically, they can, but economically, it's just way too expensive.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, if you recall Gorbachev and Reagan's summits, there was a kind of measured panic in the Soviet reaction to all of this. And eventually, of course, it wound up doing exactly what the Reagan National Security team thought it would, and that was just bust up the Soviet Union. But the other thing that Reagan was doing at the same time as he's pushing this, you recall, is he's giving all of these very strange speeches about alien invasions.
Yeah.
And what would we do if we were confronted with an alien invasion? Well, we'd band together and we'd fight.
Yeah.
Well, fight with what?
Yeah.
Jet planes and missiles and bullets are not going to do you much good against something zipping around with electrogravitic or any other sort of field propulsion. It's not going to work.
Right.
So you better be able to fire your lasers.
Yep.
So, you know, this is what I think really is going on. He's stating, in other words, publicly, the dual policy that the American national security establishment was faced with. They had to roll back communism. That was the weakest enemy confronted, and then they had a long-term potential threat in the UFO. So deal with target number one first, and then deal with target number two second.
boy.
And that's exactly what's going on. Now, for good or ill, you know, I don't have, like you, much good to say about the Anglo-American power elite.
Yeah, I don't either.
But for good or ill, for whatever reason, I think they came to the correct conclusion that whatever some of these UFOs are, it's clear that we cannot simply say that all of their intentions are good. Some
right.
of the action is clearly hostile.
Yep.
And I think they have to, you know, no self-respecting Earth government, particularly of any great power on Earth, is going to view that activity and not respond to it by a program of covert development of technologies that can at least partially duplicate the performance of what we see in some UFOs. That's the key here. So, you know, all of that vast money that we see
disappearing.
Yeah, I think this is where it's going. And I think there's a second aspect of this. I'm not trying to justify, you know, the bombing of Iran and the bombing of Syria and Iraq and everybody else that they want to go around and bomb.
Yeah.
But you have to remember that many of the people at that level of government are not the people inside of this breakaway civilization. Okay? You're dealing there with people that are not in on it. Let's put it that way. And even if you are, I think what you're looking at, to a certain degree, is you don't, this is just basic military thinking, you don't go into a posture of defensiveness against a potential conflict without making darn sure that your home base is secure.
Right.
And in this case, home base is planet Earth.
Yeah.
And the last thing that you want are independent regimes that don't share your analysis or reading of the situation. And I submit something very interesting. I just had this conversation last night with a friend of ours, Walter Bosley,
mm-hmm.
And had this conversation earlier today with someone else. If you look at what's being said in terms of space things, mm-hmm. it's like they're getting ready for something. And let me tell you what I'm thinking of.
Okay.
About a month before the Chelyabinsk meteor flew over that city in Russia.
Yeah.
And then it mysteriously exploded.
Yeah.
About a month before that happened.
Yeah.
President Dmitry Medvedev, stated that Russia should develop, that there was a need for the Earth to develop an asteroid defense system.
Yes.
And even if the rest of the Earth didn't do this, Russia should do it on her own anyway.
Yeah.
To protect Russia.
I remember that.
Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Then we had the Chelyabinsk meteor.
Yeah.
Okay? Which I think to this day is extremely suspicious given that context.
Yes,
okay?
It is.
Now, just about 2 weeks ago, and I blogged about this on the website, about 2 weeks ago, and I had to laugh when I read this, Georgianne, and I thought, you've got to be kidding me. A Japanese architectural firm in Tokyo published a plan to put microwave solar energy collectors on the moon,
mm-hmm.
okay, to gather up solar power and then beam all that power to the Earth in the form of microwaves.
It could try
us. Hang on, for electricity. Okay.
Oh, boy.
Now, they wanted to build this on a on a scale that's unimaginable. They wanted to do this on a planetary scale. They wanted to put these solar panels around the entire equator of the moon.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, when I read that, I may have talked about this before on your show. I don't know. But if so, I apologize for repeating myself, but in case I haven't, I've got to say what I'm thinking.
Yes.
In Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, I talked about a scheme that the U.S. Air Force, I think it was, came up with in the early 1960s to put satellites in orbit and do the same thing. Put solar panels on the satellites, collect all this solar energy, beam it to the Earth in the form of microwaves, convert it to electrical power, and voila, we've got all the electricity we could ever need. There was just one catch. The power would have to have been collected on Earth bases with collection things called rec antennae, all right?
Yeah.
And the microwaves that were going to be beamed down from these little satellites in Earth orbit would have been so powerful that the area around these power collection antennae would have been inhospitable to any form of life.
Yeah.
To a radius of about, to an area of about 150 square miles.
Oh, geez.
Okay. So, you know, just draw a picture in your head of an area of 150 square miles where nothing flies, nothing grows, nothing lives, but we're getting electricity.
Yeah.
And that's from satellites. Mm. Now imagine the whole moon doing this.
Oh, brother.
And when I read this, Georgianne, I laughed for precisely that reason, because, yeah, just like you said, you could end up cooking North America or crisping Europe, you know.
Setting the whole world on fire.
the whole, it's a Death Star.
Yeah.
So the Japanese come out and publish this idea, and, you know, this architectural firm drew up the plans.
Oh, gee.
You know, the... Now, this from a country that's melting into radiation, okay?
Yeah.
Now, the Japanese no sooner had done this than about 3 days later, the Chinese came out and said, yeah, we ought to turn the moon into a Death Star.
Oh,
and the Chinese were just right up front about it. That's the phrase they used.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, I'll tell you what I think is going on. Look what we have here. We have Russia.
Yeah.
We need an asteroid defense system.
Uh-huh.
We have Japan. Let's turn the moon into a solar power electricity generator.
Oh, really?
We have China. Oh, why do that? Let's just turn the whole moon into a Death Star. Okay?
Yeah.
But you see what's going on here, I hope? They're letting out the long-term strategic military threat.
Yeah.
They're letting out the fact that everybody in positions of power in those technologically advanced nations, they're letting out in a roundabout way that there's a threat out there and we've got to prepare for it. That's what they're doing. And they're doing it in a very clever way. You know, we expect, for good or ill, you know, I really don't think the Chinese government is that, I don't see it as being that desperate for world domination.
Yeah.
Okay? I just don't. And, you know, you can write me your angry emails after the show. But by the same token, I don't think the Japanese are so stupid or insane as to believe that beaming microwave gathered from the moon
really?
It's a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, they're just not that stupid. So there's something else going on. By the same token, the Russians know full well that any asteroid defense system that they would build would be inadequate to protect the entire planet.
Right.
Okay, so what they're really saying here is this is a controlled release of information. That's what this is.
Wow.
And they're getting other people to say it. Because who is going to listen if the U.S. comes out and says, we ought to be doing this? No one would listen to us. It would be just another scheme of Yankee imperialism.
Yeah.
And you can't blame them,
given
the behavior of this country in the last 10, 15 years. So they're choosing other countries to make these announcements. And let's turn the clock further back. Remember what got all of these strange space announcements started?
What?
The Vatican.
Oh, yeah.
It's okay to baptize ETs if we encounter them.
Well, you know, a few years ago, Joseph, and I grabbed the article off the net.
Uh-huh.
A few years ago, Russia had put a huge mirror into space, and that was the end of no more articles about it.
Yeah. Well, the space mirror idea, that's the original idea actually comes from the Nazis, and even before, if I recall correctly, Jules Verne, the science fiction author, had a similar idea. But what we're really being prepared for is a militarization of space, but this idea of using the entire moon.
That's wacko.
Well, no, it's not wacko. Oh. But no, you're misunderstanding. That means that they are confronted with something giant and colossal.
Yeah.
That means that you know, simply sticking a little laser on a truck ain't gonna do it.
Right.
You see, their concern or the threat that they are concerned about is much, much bigger.
Bigger, yeah.
And much more dangerous. So they're preparing us, you know, asteroids. Do we really think that we're going to mine asteroids or blast asteroids that are threatening to the Earth with rockets?
No.
No. Sorry. Ain't going to happen. So my thinking is, you're looking at messages being sent back and forth between the great powers.
Yeah.
You know, they float these balloons to see how the other nations are going to respond. And to me, the most interesting thing here is the Japanese float their little moon solar power plant idea, and the Chinese immediately respond, yeah, we know what you're talking about. Here's what we ought to do. And here's what we think it is. So they're sending messages back and forth to each other, and this is controlled release. They're getting everybody on the same page. Do you see the same thing we're seeing, and what do we do about it? Yeah, we see the same thing that you're seeing, and this is what we got to do. So they're getting us ready for something, I think.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, why else would all this wackiness be going on?
Yeah, exactly. There isn't a good... there isn't a good rationalization for the scale of it.
Right.
Because, you know, if you try and rationalize this on normal, everyday categories, it makes no sense. It's a form of insanity. So either these people are insane, and, you know, 4 days out of the week, I think they are.
How about five?
Five. Okay, I'll go five. But, you know, the other 2 days of the week, you know, they're acting like coldly calculating rational individuals. So I'm proposing this analysis as part of they're acting in cold rational calculation part here. This is the only way I can explain all of these dots and have them connect and make any sense. I think we're looking at controlled release of information.
Yeah.
I think that the reason that the United States isn't saying this is that it lacks currently the moral capital to come out and say these things and be taken seriously. You know, the Japanese, they're no threat to anybody unless they're bombing your fleet. But, I think this is what's going on, and the Russians can get away with saying it because they're unbelievably their moral capital is a lot higher than the West's moral capital right
now. Boy, you can say that again. We have some of the most asinine politicians.
Well,
I'm not
saying that Medvedev or Mr. Putin are saints, you know, they're anything but.
Yeah.
You know, look at the system that they came out of. That's going to have a moral effect on you. But, at least they're not incompetent and stupid.
Yeah.
You know, we have politicians that are are both corrupt and stupid.
And mentally unbalanced.
And mentally unbalanced.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Check out my data blog.
Okay. 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 I will do so.
Oh, boy. I'll tell you, Joseph, is the reason, we talked about this a long time ago, is the reason that they do not mind killing large numbers of human beings because they know that their soul survives after death?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think there's three big secrets to the aliens. At the very top, I think there's three big secrets.
Okay.
When I've said this before on your show, most people think that at the very top, the elite do not believe that God exists.
Mm-hmm.
All right? I think the exact opposite. I think they do. But I don't think they believe it as a matter of religious belief.
Right.
I think they know this as a matter of formally explicit knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very different thing.
Yes.
And the second thing I think that they adhere to is the, not the belief, but again as a matter of formally explicit knowledge, I think that they adhere to the idea that there is real personal immortality. And I don't say just immortality. I put it that way for a reason, because of it's coming out of a Western Judeo-Christian culture.
Yeah.
There's an immortality in the East, but it's not quite the same thing. Although, if you study it carefully, it amounts to it. But most Westerners think of it as a form of personal nihilism. The third secret I've never shared, and I'm not going to.
Oh, Joseph. You're such a rascal.
I know.
Gosh, the third secret is like...
It's not the third secret of Fatima.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like that, you know. You won't share it. Oh.
No, it would be too upsetting for 99.9% of the population.
Well, don't you think they need to be upset?
No.
I do.
No.
I think they need to be drastically upset to shake them out of their sofa-loving, beer-drinking, ball-game TV-watching.
Well, those people aren't listening to this show anyway, so
nothing I say would
shake them out of anything. You know, there's always going to be that segment of the population, but, you know, they're never the ones that lead. They're always the ones that follow.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, well... How far back do you think this high technology really goes? Excluding Germany. I mean, in history.
Well, first of all, you can't exclude Germany because most of...
Well, where did they get it from?
Well, I don't look for hidden causes. I think if you really understand the development of modern physics, and particularly quantum mechanics and all of this stuff,
yeah,
it's coming out of a German philosophical tradition that really more or less begins with Kant, although you find adumbrations of it, very strong adumbrations of it, much earlier in German history with people like Leibniz and you have the whole Hermetic influence from the Renaissance that's very, very strong inside of Germany, alchemy and so on. So you've got all of these things that form a very rich conceptual culture in Germany, out of which the ideas behind quantum mechanics you can trace directly to some of these philosophical schools, Kant in particular.
Yeah.
So you can't exclude Germany. It's just not feasible. But how far back? I think, quite frankly, and I'm going to say something that will sound very strange, to people that are very familiar with the world of ufology.
Okay.
I think that the airship mysteries of the 1850 all the way up to the close of the 19th century.
Yeah.
I think there is much more going on there than most people have given it credit for. The way most people view the airship mysteries is that these are just kind of primitive, clunky Zeppelins flying around. Well, the reported speed of some of these airships is about 200 miles an hour. That's a lot faster than any Zeppelin or any dirigible ever flew.
Yeah.
There's something else going on with this whole phenomenon that's never, ever been adequately explained. Not the least is the technology. Not the least are the people involved.
Mm-hmm.
And there are both American connections, German connections. There's a lot more going on there, Georgianne, than meets the eye, that anyone has ever yet really fathomed. And there are some good books on the airship phenomenon out there. They're precious few. But even those books really haven't done the phenomenon full justice. So that's the problem. So it could go as far back as the middle of the 19th century.
Well, going back into biblical literature.
Right. Even further, if you want to take it that far back.
Yeah, that's what I was aiming at.
Yeah.
There's a lot of instances where it would be very easy to deduce that they were talking about UFO.
Well, sure, yeah. You know, the only thing that the reason I didn't go there is because we don't have a consistent or clear continuity of people or institutions over time
mm-hmm.
examining that phenomenon.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So in other words, this breakaway group that Mr. Dolan is talking about, if it looks at anything like that, it's going to look at the airship mystery, it's going to look at its own knowledge of black projects, it's going to look at the Nazi developments, and then taking all those into consideration, it's going to go back and look at those texts.
Mm-hmm.
And say, okay, yeah, we see possible evidence of this activity, so there's something else here other than just merely a human presence that we know about that's doing this. But in terms of humans involved with this technology and developing it, you can trace it clearly back to the middle of the 19th century.
Yeah.
It's that development that's very mysterious. It comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, you've got that very strange German-American connection that's involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears at right about the same time. This is what people need to start learning how to do in this field, and that's connecting dots. That's going outside your narrow scope of interest and being familiar with what's happening in other fields. Well, the reason I mentioned circa 1850 for the beginning of the airship thing is because that's when actually it does begin, if you look at the earliest reports of it.
Yeah.
And it's right around that time that guess what happens in physics?
What?
James Clerk Maxwell publishes his treatise on the unification of magnetism and electricity.
Yeah.
So in other words, he's published a theory, and you know that as soon as that hits the bookshelves, there's going to be people tinkering around in their barns. Well, let's see what we can do with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no Maxwell, no Tesla.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
that's the be-all and end-all right there. So it stands to reason that you're going to have something going on, and we need to remember, and I mentioned Tesla purposefully, because we need to remember that this man invented alternating current in the 19th century.
Yes.
It took almost a decade and really two decades before it catches on well enough to start lighting up the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But the technology was there for a long time, comparatively.
Yeah.
Well, by the same token, what else is Tesla doing? Well, he's going out in the middle of nowhere in Colorado and doing these very strange experiments because in the process of inventing alternating current, he's figured out that we don't even need to transmit this stuff over wires at all.
Yeah. Bless his heart.
Yeah, bless his little heart. And so, okay, he's out there in Colorado, and he's generating lightning bolts out there in the middle of nowhere that you can hear all the way in Colorado Springs.
Yeah.
You know, and people are a little nervous. I don't blame them, you know.
Yeah.
This mad scientist is out there generating lightning bolts. And he comes back to New York when he's got his experiments concluded and makes the announcement, well, I figured out how to beam electricity anywhere in the world, and starts building his little tower there on Long Island. And lo and behold, when Morgan pulls the plug on him, Tesla, desperate for money and attention and wanting to finish this thing, starts publishing articles in the New York Times in which he says things to the effect that, oh, by the way, did I mention this would be a really cool weapon?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. So, you know, this stuff has been around for a long time. If Tesla can do this, and if it's something that is now over 100 years old, still is being suppressed. We're still transmitting electricity on wires.
Yeah, we're still using the wheel.
We're still using the electrical equivalent of the Wright Brothers airplane.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
That's the problem. If we're still in that situation, that there's something about what he did and discovered that has to be suppressed to this day,
mm-hmm.
then it doesn't stretch my imagination too much to think that there's something else going on with this airship mystery.
Yeah.
That people are not talking about publicly because they haven't connected the dots yet,
mm-hmm.
that we're not dealing simply with a bunch of inventors trying to create the Zeppelin.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry.
Exactly.
This is something else. I can't even begin to tell you. I recently bought a book. Our friend Walter Bosley came up last night, and we've had a long, long talk, and he brought a book that had been given him of the paintings of Charles Delschau, that
uh-huh.
strange German-American that was painting all these just bizarre paintings
yeah.
of these airships.
Yeah.
And I sat here, Georgianne, and flipped through that book with my mouth open.
Oh, boy.
Because it is clear, it is crystal clear, that this man is painting some sort of technology.
Yes.
He's not just picking this out of the ether and dreaming it up and coming up with wild, bizarre paintings that collectors like to collect.
In other words, he's painting something that he saw?
He's painting something that he saw
mm-hmm.
or that he was given access to.
Mm-hmm.
One or two pictures like this, you would think, okay, he's just got a creative imagination. But when you sit down and really examine these paintings and what he's doing in them, he's clearly communicating something about
yeah.
these airships that is out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
There's no two ways about it. I can't, you know, this book is an expensive book. It's about $60 because it's, you know, it's an art book. It's full of color reproductions of,
yeah.
of these paintings. But I was just kind of dumbfounded looking at these things. They're not the things that you just dream up.
Yeah.
There's some sort of kernel that inspired them that he's trying to capture in his artistic imagination, and it's not coming out of his brain. This is something else.
Yeah.
And pictures are no. Just the reports alone of these.